White Poverty: How Exposing Myths About Race and Class Can Reconstruct American Democracy by Reverend Dr. William J. Barber II with Jonathan Wilson Hartgrove. Chapter 5: Poverty is Only a Black Issue, Myth 3. If you believe the myth that says only Black people want systemic change, it's easy to think that the systems of our common life are working for most people. As with any system, say the engine in your car or the HVAC in your home, you can trust this story and still think the economy needs an occasional tune-up. Raise taxes here, cut interest rates there, invest in housing, or gradually raise wages. You don't have to think a system is perfect to believe it's basically functioning, but you do have to trust it's not going to leave you stranded by the side of the road or without any heat in the dead of winter. If you can see that a system isn't working, you want an overhaul. You take out what's broken and replace it with a new system that works. In our common life, another myth keeps us from seeing that our economic system is broken and needs to be reconstructed. It's the myth that says poverty is only a Black issue. Nothing exposes this myth like drawing near to the people who are experiencing poverty. Not long after the sister I met in Mitchell County told me that the extremist Republicans in our state house hadn't known what they were doing when they poked the bear up in the mountains, I received a call from some folks down east in Belhaven, North Carolina, who said they needed help to save their hospital. In the geography of North Carolina, the coastal town of Belhaven is about as far as you can get, 400 miles from Mitchell County. But politically, the two rural communities have a lot in common. Adam O'Neill, a stocky white man with a southern drawl, had been elected as a pro-business Republican who stood for family values and economic liberty. He knew there were lots of issues we didn't agree on, but when we met at a rally where a community group had invited me to speak outside the little city hall, we each recognized that we shared a common interest, saving the rural hospital that had been at the center of this town for more than half a century. Critical access hospitals in America's rural communities were established by the Hills-Burton Act of 1946 during the Truman administration to provide life-saving health care to America's heartland, where people often find themselves too far removed from a regional hospital to receive timely treatment in an emergency. Because they do not see the volume of patients that has become the norm at major regional hospitals, these critical access hospitals often require federal subsidies to keep the doors open. This is nothing new. Their existence has been a justified expense for millions of Americans since the mid-20th century. When Congress passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010, they planned for the essential federal funding that's needed to help keep critical access hospitals open to follow patients as to their local facilities through the expansion of Medicaid. It was, as many conservatives had lobbied for it to be, a market-driven plan. But when Tea Party reactionaries branded the new law Obamacare, the term itself a dog whistle, they pushed the entire Republican Party to resist implementation of the ACA at every stage. Many legislators controlled by Republicans like ours in North Carolina refused to accept the ACA funding to expand Medicaid. This meant that a half million uninsured North Carolinians who were technically eligible for Medicaid still couldn't get access to health care. As I've told the all-white crowd up in Mitchell County, the vast majority of those uninsured people, 350,000 of them, were white. But whatever the color of their skin, many of them lived in communities where their critical access hospitals were closing because they didn't have the money the ACA had directed to fund them through Medicaid expansion. Pungo Hospital, a simple one-story brick building, sat on the waterfront in Belhaven. In its day, it served three rural counties in northeastern North Carolina. Though the healthcare company that managed it had purchased the hospital from a local nonprofit with the promise that they would keep it open and improve services, the community was outraged because they learned that their hospital was slated to be closed. Mayor Adam had already reached out to the Republican legislators who represented his part of the state in Raleigh. They wouldn't even return my calls, he told me. He was beginning to feel what it's like when people with power believe your suffering isn't their problem. He was grateful for our support, but he said to me, "This is going to shock a lot of people. You're a Democrat and I'm a Republican." First of all, I told him, I'm not a Democrat. I've been an independent all my life and I vote like I want to vote. Well, yeah, he said, but I'm sure I support a lot of people you've stood against. Maybe so, I told him, but that's not the issue here. From what I understand, you're about to lose this hospital, and if you do, it's going to hurt everybody in this community. We shook hands and agreed to fight together in this battle. If Pungo Hospital closed its doors, the next closest emergency room was an hour's drive for some residents of northeastern North Carolina. People are going to die, Mayor Adams started saying. We worked with our lawyers in the NAACP and filed a Title VI complaint with the U.S. Department of Justice, asserting that the plan was discriminatory because it would deny Black people in eastern North Carolina access to critical care. But we knew what Mayor O'Neill understood. Closing the hospital would also impact the white Republicans who had elected him. The mayor and I went to rally together and held a press conference. Besides access to health care, we said, shouldn't be a Republican or Democrat issue. It was a moral issue. Now, Reverend Barber and I don't agree on everything, Mayor O'Neill told the reporters. Heck, we don't agree on most things, but we agree on this. We can't let people die. Nonetheless, after a short delay, the courts couldn't save the hospital from politicians who would not act to save it. When it shuttered its doors the following summer, emergency medical service workers in Hyde County made a plan for what to do if patients would have taken directly to Pungo Hospital needed emergency care. Ambulances were to drive them straight to the empty parking lot of a high school, and a helicopter would be sent to airlift the patient from there to a hospital in Norfolk, Virginia. That was the plan. Days later, Portia Gibbs, a 48-year-old mother of three, was at home in Hyde County cleaning up the yard with her husband, Barry, an Army veteran who worked in maintenance at the local school. From his riding lawnmower, Barry noticed that Portia had gone to sit down on the porch. He killed the engine and went to ask if she was okay. Her blood sugar had dropped, so he went inside and got her something to eat. But when he came back, Portia said her chest was hurting. Barry called their son to help him get Portia in the car, and Barry started driving towards the EMS station. He called ahead to let them know they were coming, and when they got there, four EMS workers put Portia in the back of an ambulance and got her stabilized. Then they told Barry they'd have to call for the helicopter. Barry followed the ambulance to the high school parking lot and sat there for more than 45 minutes. One of the EMS workers came out to tell him that they had to resuscitate Portia several times. They'd called the local doctor who'd run Belhaven's hospital for decades to get his advice. He told them it didn't sound good. By the time the helicopter arrived, there was nothing they could do to save her. Portia Gibbs, just 48, became the first recipient of the death sentence that Mayor Adams had seen coming. Despite his best efforts, a white Republican mayor in a so-called red county couldn't ensure life-saving health care for a white woman from the next county over because state leaders from his own party wouldn't even talk to him. Portia Gibbs' unnecessary death was nothing less than a crime. If it had happened because of the intentional neglect of lawmakers who were distracted by other responsibilities, they would still be culpable. But this was far worse than that. Her life had somehow slipped through the cracks. We had petitioned legislators at Moral Monday events to expand Medicaid. Hundreds of us had gone to jail when they told us to be quiet. Mayor Adams had come to the State House and told members of his own party that their decision to refuse Medicaid expansion was going to kill people. Gibbs' death was, by any honest account, intentional. This was policy murder. The perpetrators who made the law could not be tried for their crime in a court of law. We knew we had to take this case to the courts of public opinion. Just like Ida B. Wells insisted on telling the truth about lynching victims, even as the dominant narrative blamed the victims for the violence committed against them and against democracy, we knew we had to tell the truth about the policy murders that were being committed to expose the myth that says poverty is only a Black issue. Early on a June morning, I rode through rows of loblolly pines in the familiar two-lane highway of northeastern North Carolina, where I had grown up, to meet some folks who had pledged to walk with Mayor Adams from Belhaven to Washington, D.C., 300 miles on bubbling asphalt under the southern summer, sun. All to tell a different story about why Portia Gibbs had died. When we arrived at a little park on the Pungo River in Bellhaven, just across the water from the shuttered hospital, I saw black folks dressed in t-shirts and tennis shoes gathered with white men in Lacoste polo shirts and penny loafers. Young people who planned to walk the whole way were holding backpacks with the essentials they needed for a 2-week journey. In the midst of the crowd, I spotted Bob Zellner, a gregarious white man in his 70s at the time, throwing his head back and laughing so hard that his dimpled cheeks buried his eyes. Many of the folks gathered in that park didn't know his story, but Bob was in Bellhaven because he was a white Southerner who had joined the movement for a multi-ethnic democracy in America in the late 1950s while still a college student in Montgomery, Alabama. When his sociology professor at the time assigned a paper on the race problem, Bob went to a meeting that the Southern Christian Leadership Conference was hosting at the First Baptist Church of Montgomery, where the Reverend Ralph Abernathy was pastor. One of the speakers at that meeting that day was Reverend Abernathy's friend, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. And when the meeting was drawing to a close, Dr. King approached Bob and some of his white college friends to let them know that police officers outside the church were planning to arrest them for violating the city's segregation ordinance. Bob said he hadn't come to break the law, but to do research for a paper. Was there some way they could avoid getting arrested? Dr. King introduced the students to a woman who offered to take them to the back door of the church while he created a diversion by exiting from the front door and making a statement to the press about the meeting. After she had walked them to the door, Mrs. Rosa Parks grabbed Bob by the elbow before he made a run for it and whispered in his ear, "At some point, when you see something that's wrong, you have to stop studying the problem and do something about it." Bob never forgot her challenge, and when freedom riders traveled to Montgomery and faced the brutality of the Ku Klux Klan at the local bus station in 1961, he was inspired by their courage to join the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee as its first white staff member. Bob learned to use the power of nonviolence to confront Jim Crow because he saw how segregation hurt his black neighbors. He says he has stayed in this struggle all these years, though, because he came to understand how the politics of white supremacy also hurt people like him. When SNCC became an all-black organization in the late 1960s, Bob was the last white staff person to leave. Yet Bob never understood leaving SNCC to be a departure from the work of building a multi-ethnic movement for democracy. He went to Louisiana in the 1970s and organized white woodworkers, some of whom were members of the Ku Klux Klan, to work with black pulp woodworkers for better wages. Bob knew he couldn't argue a Klansman out of his racism. His grandfather, a leader of the Klan in Birmingham, had once told Bob he would kill himself if he protested in his hometown. But Bob said organizing white folks in the South taught him that if a member of the Klan couldn't afford to feed his family, he could sometimes see the need to join forces with black workers in a campaign for better wages. And after black and white folks sat through planning meetings at the Union Hall together, it turned out they could sometimes even start to see one another as fellow human beings. A movement elder, Bob continues to pass on the hard-earned wisdom of organizing, often riding with college students on tours of the South to share stories from the 1960s. He moved to North Carolina in 2013 when he heard about the Moral Fusion movement that was bringing all kinds of folks together to challenge extremism in our state. And he had been one of the 17 people arrested with us on the first Moral Mondays. Now he was spending much of his time down here in Bellhaven supporting Mayor Adam and others in the community who wanted to tell the story of how Portia Gibbs, the middle-aged white woman from one of the poorest counties in North Carolina, had been killed by the extremism of white politicians who were determined to undermine the legacy of America's first black president. Bob understood how a white woman's death in an under-resourced community exposed the myth that poverty is only a black issue. As the line of marchers left the park that morning in June 2015, bound for the nation's capital, I stood at the end of Bellhaven's frontage road that passed by the shuttered hospital and thought of the funeral processions I've witnessed as a pastor. Whenever someone dies in my tradition, their family and loved ones process to the front of the sanctuary, where the body of the deceased is visible in the casket, and they say their final goodbyes. That walk is painful for any family, and I've stood at the head of many funeral processions, praying for souls who are just beginning the process of learning to live without someone they love. But as I watched Barry Gibbs walk past me that morning in Bellhaven, I knew I was watching a man whose grief was compounded by the fact that God had not called his wife home. Legislators who were supposed to represent them had abandoned her to an untimely death. Mr. Gibbs had taken his wife's ashes home and buried them beneath an evergreen in the yard where they'd been working together when she had a heart attack. But he wasn't going to let that be the end of her story. This procession was a form of public mourning for all the unnecessary deaths that were plaguing communities like this one, a declaration that policy murder could no longer go unchallenged. Mayor Adam was right. Some people were shocked to see the president of North Carolina NAACP working with a Republican mayor to try to save a hospital. I was surprised on one occasion when I attended an annual 4th of July parade focused on reopening the hospital to find myself riding on the back of a truck with a Confederate flag bumper sticker. But our shared struggle and mourning exposed the lie of the story that said only Black people suffer if you reject federal programs designed to serve poor rural communities. We, like many who'd come before us, were experiencing the importance of challenging the myth that lets politicians pretend poverty is something that only affects those people. When Ida B. Wells insisted on telling the truth about the men who were lynched in her hometown of Memphis in 1892, she was mourning the loss of Black neighbors she had known. At the same time, she was also declaring that their unnecessary deaths were more than an attack on Black people. They were an attack on the promise of democracy. For decades, from the 1890s through the 1920s, well-investigated lynchings to unearth Jim Crow's strategy to undermine Reconstruction and maintain an economy that did not serve most Americans. She was a witness to the fact that you can't expose a myth by simply calling it out. You have to help people see the reality that the myth is designed to obscure. In 1955, more than two decades after Wells died of kidney disease in Chicago, a young Black teen from the same city was spending the summer with family in Mississippi, as many kids did at the time. After Carolyn Bryant, a 21-year-old white woman, accused the boy of whistling at her, Emmett Till, all of 14, was lynched by a mob of white men by Bryant's husband, Roy, and his half-brother, J.W. Milam. In 2007, when she was in her 70s, Bryant confessed that nothing that boy ever did could justify what happened to him. Mamie Till Mobley, Emmett's mother, did not have to wait a half century to know that her son's actions could never have justified his death. She understood immediately what Wells had recognized decades before. To expose the myth that said a Black boy was a threat to a white woman, she had to compel people to see the harsh realities that myth obscures. Yes, she had to grieve the loss of a baby she had carried in her womb, welcomed into this world, and nurtured into adolescence, unspeakable grief for any mother. Still, she decided that her personal grief couldn't be separated from the public mourning that was necessary to put a face on the violence that Jim Crow enabled. Her decision not only played a critical role in the civil rights movement, it also offered a model for how a moral fusion movement can compel the public to face the crisis of poverty, which is often obscured by the myth that says poverty is only a Black issue. After her son's body was returned to Chicago in a sealed casket on a train car, Mrs. Mamie said she could smell the stench when she entered the station to claim him, but she insisted that they open the casket and let her see the abuse her child had endured and smell the rot that had ensued after his body was dumped in a river. It was then that Miss Mamie said she decided to hold an open casket funeral, where some 50,000 mourners in Chicago could witness the swollen face of her boy. She invited the media to show the world what Jim Crow had done to Emmett. After the funeral, she traveled the country telling the truth about what had happened. Rosa Parks heard the story that fall on a special program at Dexter Avenue Baptist Church in Montgomery. She saw the photos from that funeral in Jet Magazine. And she said she knew when she saw that horrific image that she had to take direct action to confront Jim Crow in Alabama. What we now call the civil rights movement began because one mother took action to put a face on an unnecessary death and expose the myth that said it was justifiable. As I watched the mourners march out of Belhaven that summer morning, I prayed that Portia Gibbs' death might expose the myth that perpetuates policy murder today by persuading so many Americans that the issue of poverty, things like basic access to health care, are black issues and not moral issues that impact 140 million poor people in America. I realize that some readers might think it's strange to connect the death of Portia Gibbs to that of Emmett Till, who is remembered, along with his brave mother, among the pantheon of civil rights figures. The circumstances of their death are of course, different. And Portia Gibbs did not face the rank prejudice and bigotry that resulted in Till's murder. But both of their deaths expose a myth, and I want to lift up Portia's Gibbs as an example of the thousands of deaths that are occurring as rural hospitals are closed and millions go without access to health care in this nation, all because far too many continue to believe that systemic injustice is only a black issue. In this case, I offer Portia Gibbs' name as the face of all such victims because I know we need a face and a narrative to begin such a movement. If Till's death became a catalyst for change, it wasn't because it was exceptional. Sadly, the opposite was true. Till's death was representative of the violence that Jim Crow enacted on millions of people. For far too long, most Americans couldn't see how separate but equal codified a way of life that meant unnecessary violence and death for millions of people. If Portia Gibbs' death was but a single example of the policy murder that was impacting millions of Americans, then to remember her was to ask how we could compel the nation to see what was really happening with poverty. A walk to DC alone wasn't going to change the dominant narrative about who's poor and why. Part of the challenge I began to understand is figuring out how to shift what Americans think we know about poverty. I remember when I was growing up in the South in the late 1960s and 70s that any time the local news station covered a story about poverty, the images that rolled in the background of the white narrator's voice were always of black people, usually black women with a crowd of children, Mother Goose-like, standing in line somewhere waiting for help. This was the era when public voices in the South were beginning to shed all explicit references to racism in the wake of the civil rights movement. At the height of America's war on poverty, it was also the peak of federal investment in any anti-poverty programs. Programs that, by any honest account, significantly improved the lives of Black and white Americans. But at precisely the moment when more white Americans than ever before were receiving federal help to climb out of poverty through Head Start vouchers, Medicaid for their children, food stamps, and the Earned Income Tax Credit, we were trained by the media to imagine poverty as a black problem. The public was falsely led to believe that anti-poverty programs only benefited black people. Tragically, this fallacy persists to this day. Such racist depictions were not always the case. During the Great Depression, when economic hardships touched so many Americans' lives, including images of hobos riding the rails, men standing in bread lines, the poor women struggling to feed their children were overwhelmingly pictures of white people. President Franklin Delano Roosevelt's administration commissioned photographers to document poverty for the Federal Resettlement Administration, later called the Farm Security Administration. In 1936, Dorothea Lange, a white woman originally from New Jersey, took her camera into a pea field in California and spotted Florence Owens Thompson, a mother of seven who sat chin in hand with a furrowed brow, her children clinging to her tattered clothes underneath a makeshift tent. "I saw and approached the hungry and desperate mother," Lange later wrote, "as if drawn by a magnet. I do not remember how I explained my presence or my camera to her, but I do remember she asked me no questions." Lange titled the series of five exposures she made that day, "Migrant Mother." This picture of a woman who looked white became the iconic image of the Great Depression in textbooks and public memorials. Still, 90 or so years ago, American poverty was the plight of a white mother who'd fallen on hard times, and the imagery depicting America's poverty remained persistently white. After the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Fair Housing Act of 1968, which ensured access to anti-poverty programs for non-white Americans, the public face of poverty began to change dramatically. At the moment when we as a nation made our greatest push to expand efforts to include everyone, politicians who opposed those programs began to vilify the poor people who benefited from them. To do so, they leaned into the old myth. They effectively erased a huge swath of the white poor and created the stereotype of a black welfare queen. Beginning with the 1976 campaign for president, the former actor Ronald Reagan began citing the tale of a black woman from Chicago who drove a Cadillac to the welfare office and defrauded honest taxpayers of their hard-earned money. While white Americans were doing their best to take care of their families and share with their neighbors out of the generosity of their hearts, they learned from Reagan that a black woman was using the government to pick their pocket. If they elected him, he promised the government would stop helping black people steal from them. Reagan's mythological black boogeywoman was, in fact, based on an actual case of a con artist who sometimes went under the name Linda Taylor. Reagan had learned about her not because the government was facilitating her crimes, but rather because the Chicago Tribune reported at the time about how the government was prosecuting Taylor. A different storyteller might just as easily have emphasized the way Taylor's fraud stole from the poor people who did qualify for the government program she had scammed. Instead, Reagan used her as an anecdote to undermine programs that helped many of the hardworking everyday Americans whose votes he sought. The myth says that poverty is a black issue obscures the fact that white folks are potentially the single largest base for a movement of poor people that could demand our government address the crisis of poverty in America. The perpetuation of the black-only poverty myth allows politicians to pretend that the system is basically working for most people, that if the economy is growing, we'll all benefit from a trickle-down soon enough. When poor white people experience the daily struggle that suggests things aren't working for them, the same myth suggests that someone else is to blame. As long as Americans can be divided by identity politics and cultural wedge issues, this is not a single political coalition that has the power to change how we think about poverty and thus what we can do about it. But when poor white people begin to see how their own well-being is tied up with the fortunes of other poor people, they and their allies, all who care about the common good, become an overwhelming majority of the American population. It's sadly true that we couldn't save Pungo Hospital. Bulldozers leveled the little brick building where almost every baby in three counties had been delivered for decades in order to make room for waterfront condos. But that community's determination to share Portia Gibbs' story echoes the wisdom of Ida Wells, even Mamie Mobley, and almost every other movement that's been able to shatter age-old myths in order to reconstruct America. When we help people see the real pain that people are suffering, it can indeed break the spell of the myths that blind us. A white woman now lies buried in Hyde County. I maintain that she is a powerful example that poverty isn't just a black issue. It's the justice issue that every American must face.